Well, it is indeed a pleasure to be here tonight, and I thank you for the invitation to come before you tonight and tell you what the Lord means to me and what the Lord has done for me in a word of testimony. It is a bit daunting being here as well, I have to say, to be in the church where your brother preaches, and not really because I'm afraid of what he would think about me. In fact, I would say maybe he should be more fearing what I will say about him. But it's because some of you, the length of time he's been here, there's certain things about the family that you will already know. And being here in the church with him as your minister all this time, you would have to sort of say that after all this time preaching, you would likely say that he must have a certain ability to talk in public by now. And some of you might know my sister as well, and she's headmistress in the Christian school. And it's likely that you would say about her in that job that she also would have a certain ability to speak in public. And then my wife, she teaches, and you would, I suppose, say the same about her. And there would be that fear that because of all that, and if you know all that, that you would be expecting a wee bit more than maybe you would get from me, that you would expect me to have this ability as well, that you would think to yourself, well, this must be something that the Danes do. Well, let me assure you tonight that that's not what the Danes do, or not this one anyway. And if you were to think of it as anybody who does a wee bit of breeding of animals or dogs and things like that, no matter how well you choose the bloodline of particular animals, when you get a litter of pups, you'll always get a few duds. And I'm afraid you've got the duds. You got the dud here tonight. But anyway, sometimes when I get up, I don't really like getting up. But my wife has accused me at times of saying too much once I do. So in case you fall asleep tonight, and in case I do, I'm going to summarise my testimony in, and it's in Ephesians 2 verse 8. And it's a well-known verse. You don't have to turn it up because you'll know it. For by grace are you saved through faith, and not of yourselves. It is the gift of God. And that would be my testimony in a nutshell tonight. There was nothing I done to deserve being saved. There's nothing I done to deserve God's mercy. But it was simply a gift that God gave to me. And it is a gift that I freely received. And you know, I would hope and pray tonight that if anybody is here tonight and you feel God talking to you tonight, and if he's offering you this gift of salvation, that you as well will partake of that, that you take him into your heart. Now, we weren't brought up in a Christian home. Our family was, you could say, in two halves. Gordon was the oldest, and then I was about a year and a bit younger than that. But then there was about an 8-year gap between myself and Amanda, and then another year to Ian. So most of my childhood, I would say that I remember with Gordon. And I would say that we were very different. Gordon was would have been more the type that was into reading books. He would have always had, I can remember these sets of Penguin books, and they covered every king from our present queen down to the Egyptians and Romans and things like that, and he would have been able to tell you all about them. And he would have spent his time reading things like that, reading up on things like that, and he would have had his bits of his bedroom set out with these all these soldiers, and he would have had them all precisely laid out the way it would have been in them days. And I, on the other hand, had no interest in books. And I was the type that would have been always out. I never wanted to be in. My mother had a job even to get me in for my dinner. and she would have had me bother getting me home at night to go to bed. And I wanted to spend the whole time out. I would have been out, and we had a pool near us, and I would have spent an awful lot of time in the swimming pools and things. And we would have, I suppose any family, we have our quarrels, you know, and Gordon and I suppose would have had our disagreements now and again. Now, when you're young and that sort of age, a year of difference in age makes an awful difference. And I have to confess that in the fights, I very rarely got the better of them. And normally, I would have had a short enough fuse when I was sort of young. And but it used to frustrate me awfully that he would have been able to put me down. And sometimes he would have sat on me until I cooled down. But I can remember one night in particular, something had been going on all day, and we had been at each other like families do, like brothers do maybe. And I had tried to my best to get my one over him, but couldn't the whole day. And so I waited that night, and I lay awake until he went to sleep. And then I got up and I hit him the greatest box in the mouth that I could possibly do. And then I ran and locked myself in the toilet so that he wouldn't get me. So you can see that I'm quite a nice chappy. Well, we were sent along. On Sundays, we were sent along to the Methodist Sunday school. And I'm not going to tell you that we didn't hear the gospel there, because I don't remember. I don't really remember an awful lot about it. I can remember learning catechism, or I can remember learning passages out of the Bible, but I don't remember an awful lot more about that. But when after Sunday school, we would have came out to the front of the Sunday school door, and my father would have collected us there. And if he was standing there, we knew we were going to church. But if he was there in the car, he was collecting us, and we weren't going to church. And that, I have to say, that was always a wee bit preferable, you know. And because I wouldn't say that I was very fond of church. And I know up to now I've been sort of painting myself as the delinquent, and you're probably thinking of your minister, well, he's not a bad fella. And I don't think he was that fond of church at that stage either. Well, maybe he was, you know, because in the pew where we sat, overlooking the minister in the gallery, I would say it may still be possible that if you were to go into that church, that you may find your minister's name engraved in one of the pews there. So he wasn't. Now, it'll not be the Reverend Gordon, Ian, I have to say now, but, or at least I hope it's not. But so he wasn't that great either. So he had his moments too. But one Sunday it was either late 1967 or 1968, my father was sitting outside the Sunday school in the car, and we jumped in, and we thought we were for home. And he said to us, "Now, today you have a choice," he says. He says, "I would like to go to this small church in Lisbelaw, and it'll only be a wee small meeting. Or," he says, "if you really want, we can just go to the church as normal." And at that age, I was about 7 or 8. We had to have this quick spin out in the car to Lisbelaw for a start off, or else. So a quick spin in the car, that was a plus for a start off. But when you're that age, you sort of group things together, and maybe not necessarily through, you know. But I had grouped things together in my mind about this small place in Lisbelaw, and I had thought to myself, right, this is a small church. There'll be a small congregation. It'll be a small meeting, a short sermon. I'll get out quick, and that's what I thought when I was going to this church. But that was my first introduction to the Reverend Ivan Foster. He was the minister there, and an awful lot of them predictions, of course, weren't going to be right, because I don't think Mr. Foster would be somebody known for his short sermons. My father was saved, and we started attending Lisbalaw then more regular. We were sent along to the Sunday school there, and I can thank God for many of the faithful people in that Sunday school, many of the Sunday school teachers. Now, I could name some of them here, but probably you wouldn't know many of them. The one that you might know would be Edna Weir. She would have been one of the first full-time child evangelists in the Free Presbyterian Church, and maybe some of you would know her. But I can remember often being quoted John 3:16, and that was another verse that means a lot to me. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish but have everlasting life. You know, she explained to me that God loved me so much and he gave a Son for me. And you know, I was really taken by the message, you know, that I heard in that Sunday school. And there was things that I'd never heard before, that I don't believe that I'd ever heard before. There was some things that I was worried about. I remember the first time I heard somebody talking about being born again. I was worried about that because I was in P5 at the time. I didn't like school. And I wondered to myself, was I going to have to start school again if I got born again? And that worried me a lot because that would have put me off it completely if I had to start school again. But I thank God that on the 26th of July 1970 that I came to know the Saviour, that I gave my life to him. And you know, it was in a wee caravan. It was a wee small church. There wasn't many rooms. And Edna's sister Barbara used to bring a small caravan down every weekend, and it was used for the Sunday school. And you know, sometimes we think we can't do anything for God. Sometimes not everybody will be a preacher, not everybody will be a children's worker, and sometimes we tend to say, well then, you know, we can't really do anything for the Lord. But, you know, Barbara Weir, she brought that caravan down, you know, and I believe when she goes to be home with the Lord, that she'll have a star in her crown, another star in her crown for what she has done. You know, when I was saved, I was age 10. And I remember one time giving my testimony and saying, well, I was 10 year old. And really, at 10 year old, you haven't really done very much. You can't say you have done anything really, really bad. I'd realised I was a sinner. I'd realised my need. But I hadn't done really anything terribly wrong. And you know, just after having given my testimony one night, I was on duty as a policeman in Ballymallard. I was checking the route with an explosives dog for a van parade. And an old neighbour came up to me. Now, this was a neighbour who would have no love for the Lord at all. She was a woman by the name of Mrs. Ritchie. And she said to me, you know, I was awfully surprised when I heard that you'd joined the police. And I thought, well, right, you know what? And I thought maybe she thought I was a wee bit dense and wouldn't have been capable of something like that. And she said, when there was any badness, anything going on about our estate at all, she says, you were always there. You were always in the middle of it. And you know why? She says, I believed that when you weren't in the middle of it, you'd organise somebody else to do it. And I thought to myself, you know, and I started thinking to myself, was I really, really that bad? And I began to wonder to myself, you know, maybe her son had used excuses and said, well, it was John Dane done it, you know, and she maybe took it all in. But you know, the more I started to think about things, and you started to remember the fireworks, the bangers that you'd put through people's letterboxes and things like that, all of a sudden it all started to come out, and you sort of, you know, she was right. But you know, the truth of that incident that came to me was, you know, there was an ungodly woman, no love really for the Lord at all, and yet she was able to point her finger at me. She was able to tell me the sins that I had committed, sins that I had long since forgot about. And, you know, I thought after that, you know, what about the Lord who forgets nothing? What about the Lord who remembers all our sins until we're saved? And I thought to myself, you know, wouldn't it be a terrible thing to go before the Lord unsaved, for him to bring up everything, all your sins? Now, I went on with the Lord for quite a number of years. I can remember, as Gordon has said, we took part in the young people's meetings. We used to give our testimony in different places. I can remember taking part in the quiz, being part of the quiz team. My mother tells me that she was still unsaved at the time. She tells me that I was the chief one in the family that used to try to persuade her to come to church. And I have to say now that I don't remember doing that, but she said that I'd done that. And I went on for quite a number of years with the Lord. But, you know, towards the end of the high school, I began to slip away. And, you know, it's a familiar pattern, you know, when we backslide, because the prayer life stopped, the reading of the Bible stopped. And these are all things that are always a sign of the backslider. I slipped away. I seen my friends, I seen people at school going to the dances, the discos, the formals, and I wanted to go to them things too. And I wanted to be, they seemed to be having all this fun, and I thought, I want to do that too. I want to be part of that too. And I think the final, I suppose, nail was that in 1978, I joined the police. Up until then, the family influence kept me away from that. But when I joined the police and I was away from home, I was able to go to these things and nobody knew. You know, and sin will take you further than you want, because they started off with the small things and they gradually moved up. They started off with maybe some of the social type things. Then it became a barn dance, and then it became a disco, and then it just was anything that anybody else was doing, I wanted to do it too. And, you know, there is absolutely, I can't say that it was, I can't blame anybody for it. I can't blame for anybody for falling away. You know, 1 Corinthians 10, verse 13 said, "There hath no temptation taken you, but such is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that you are able, but will with the temptation make a way to escape that you are able to bear it." So I can't say that I have any excuse for being away from the Lord at all. There's no excuse. I can't say there was. Now, I was away from the Lord, living in the world for quite a number of years. You know, and during that time I was in the police, I had plenty of reminders of how short life could be. I spent 2 years in Strabane. The last day in Strabane, one of my colleagues on his first day of duty out of the depot was shot in the Clady checkpoint. I went straight from there to Oma. The first day in Oma, I attended the shooting of a part-time reserve man in the 6 Mile Cross area. And, you know, I had plenty of reminders how sudden that God could cut us off, how God could cut us off at any time. And it could be with great suddenness. I went into dog section in 1982. And for quite a number of years, I handled just an explosives search dog. Now, this meant that you ended up at the majority of scenes of incidents. And so I would have seen quite a lot of things that happened during that time. I was in Carrickmore. One night we had been on patrol, and the dog section accommodation was separate from the rest of the accommodation. Now, there would have been those that would have said that it was the smell, because dog hunters tended to smell like their dogs because they were with them all day. But we had a porta cabin out the back of the station. It was just a room, and on either side there was a bedroom. And in the little room, you would have had maybe a wee television set or something like that. And one night I was sitting, and the dog was in beside me, and I heard a small explosion. And I thought to myself, you know, that sounds like an explosion in the distance. And I can remember getting up and opening the door and the dog walking past me. And the next minute there was an almighty explosion, and the whole place shook. And it was then that I realised that we were being martyred. And I called the dog in again, and I lay down. And after a few seconds, I thought, well, there must have been just the one. And I was just getting up again, and then there was another explosion. And this time it landed right beside the building I was in, and the bedroom at the back of the building I was in took a fair bit of the brunt of that explosion. A lot of the stuff fell in round me. A lot of the light fittings came down, the wall came in round me. And again, I lay for a few minutes and didn't know whether to get up or not. And then there was another explosion, and this went on for 9 times. There was a delay set in each one, and I think the idea was that the mortars were launched from the back of a lorry, and when the first one took off, the probies knew that it started a rocking motion within the recoil started a rocking motion in the lorry, and it would have meant that the rest of them would have been inaccurate. So that they gave this time delay so that it would have time to stop rocking, and then the second another one would have went off, and then another one. And so when we had a roll call after that, there was a young fellow who had been out with that day, and he sadly lost his life in that incident. 6 months later, we were out on a patrol. We had been left off by helicopter out in a place called Loch McCrory outside Omagh, and we're heading into Carrickmore, and as we walked along, now, there was a reason that I couldn't use my dog at this stage, but it would take a long time to explain it. So just to say that I wasn't working my dog at this stage, but I was out in the front of the patrol. And out in the front of me on the fields, about 100 yards out into the fields, and about 50 to 100 yards ahead, there were two what we called flank men. And their purpose was to look for command wires going down towards the road, and also to put off anybody who might have been sitting on the end of a command wire. And they had got slightly ahead of us because we had been stopping vehicles on the road. And as they waited on us, they had got a bit ahead of us. They waited on us. They seen a car sitting at the side of the road. And one of them done something that in the particular patrol that I was in was just something that was a no-no, and with the sergeant that was there, he did not like anybody on the flank going onto the road at all. It had to be checked, as far as he was concerned, by the dog first. But he decided he would go onto the road, and he came onto the road. The car reversed away. It was a Probie Active Service unit. Somebody, they were setting up a device as they reversed away, and he came out onto the road. He was blowing up off the road. Now, fortunately, he survived that. He had been in the mortar attack 6 months earlier, the same as myself, and he had bust his eardrums. He had just come back off the sick, and his eardrums were bust for the second time. So I had plenty of reminders of how fragile life could be. I had accidents in cars. I was maybe a wee bit mad in cars. I would have thought to myself to be a bit of a rally driver, and probably drove beyond what I was capable of. I had the dubious honour of rolling the first armoured police car. These police cars were armoured, these armoured Cortinas, and they were armoured at great expense. Probably nowadays there would be maybe equivalent to 50-odd thousand it would have cost to build one. At that time it was 20 or 30 or something like that. And we were rarely allowed them. We were only allowed to use Land Rovers. But to relieve the men on the Clady checkpoint so that we didn't stick out so much, we were allowed to use these armoured Cortinas. So this brand new one had come to the station, and I thought, well, I'm going to have a wee go with this to see how fast this goes. And I came round a corner too fast, lost it up onto a bank and over onto its roof. And we did have a fortunate escape, because it was the first time that it was found out that when you put an armoured car over onto its roof, you can't get out of it, because the windows don't open. And when the weight of the car comes down onto the roof, well, then the doors don't open either. And that's probably much what happened to them young fellows in towards Uri there, Warren Point there. That's probably what happened to them too. They weren't able to get out. There was escape hatches put into them after that, you know, but you had to find the key to open them. It wasn't just as handy as just pulling a handle and opening them. So I had plenty of warning. I had plenty of warning about how fragile life was. We could have been burnt in that accident. We ended up, the back of the vehicle was up a hill, and I could see the petrol running out of the vehicle, and it was running down round the roof of the car. And I have to say that I mightn't have got roasted in the car, but I did get a roasting when I got back to the station, and the chief inspector got his hands on me. And it was quite a while before I was allowed to drive a police car after that. But you know, friends, if you're a Christian here today and you have backslidden, if you have been saved, if you were saved, if it wasn't just a false profession that you made, if you were truly saved and you have fallen away, you know, you'll not fit into the world. I didn't fit into the world. I knew I didn't fit into the world, but I was trying my best to fit into the world. And you know, it was brought home to me one night. I was out in the Valley Hotel in a nightclub, and I was out with two Roman Catholic fellas. One of them was a policeman, and the other was a fella who's family owned the Modern Tire Service business. And the two of them were having an argument about something. I don't remember what it was about. And they were arguing away, and I really wasn't passing much remarks to them at all. And eventually they arrived over to me, and they said, "We want you to settle this argument, because we know you'll tell the truth." So whatever it was about, they told me, and I must have given a response. And I went to one of them afterwards, and I says, "What made you think that I would tell you the truth?" And he says, "You know, you're different. You're different from us." And I was sort of taken aback by that. I says, "Well, what way am I different?" He says, "You don't smoke. You don't drink. You don't go with bad women. You don't do all these other things that we do. And, you know, you're different. And we know you're different." And I couldn't get over that there was me trying to fit into the world. And you know, I didn't. And I would have walked about the Valley Hotel and these other nightclubs, and I would have drank. I didn't drink, but I would have had Coke, but I would have got the Coke put into a pint glass so that I fitted in the same as everybody else. I looked as if I was doing the same as everybody else. But you know, I didn't fit in. And you know, if you're saved, you'll not fit into the world. I remained in that state for, as I say, for a while, but there was a meeting, special meetings that the Reverend McRae had, and I went to them meetings. And I thank God that after them meetings that I came back to the Lord. I came home and I got down at my bedside and I asked the Lord to restore me. And you know, since that, I have failed the Lord on numerous occasions. And you know, if you say you've no sin, you're a liar. That's what the Bible says. And so I'll probably continue to fail the Lord at times, you know, but I can thank him that he's never failed me. He's always been with me. When I came back to the Lord, I prayed that the Lord would send me a partner, a Christian partner, a saved partner. And, you know, I thank God that he did. I thank God for my wife, Bernice, you know, and she's stood by me. She's been with me. And, you know, she's helped me. She's put on the brakes at times when I would have went astray again. And, you know, I can thank God for her as well, you know. And I met her through my sister. They both trained to be teachers. They both started Stranmillis together. And she started coming down to our house now and again. And that's how I first came across her. Do you know, I wouldn't have been the sharpest tool in the toolbox, you know, when it would come to talking to girls, I have to say, I have to admit that. And you know, it took me quite a while to pluck up the courage to ask her out. And she had been coming down to our house for quite a while. And there's a bit of a gap between our ages, and I thought, well, she'll not be interested in an old boy like me. And but you know, I believe that the Lord's hand was on us meeting. She had been down one weekend, and as usual, I thought to myself, this is the weekend that I'll ask her out. And the weekend went, and I hadn't asked her out. And on the Monday after she had went home, I thought to myself, right, I'm just going to go to. She was teaching in Ballymoney at the time. And I said to myself, I'm going to go to Ballymoney and I'm going to ask her out. So off I headed to Ballymoney in my car. And you know, on my way, I was heading on my way to Omagh, and I thought to myself, I don't know my way. I don't know how to get to Ballymoney. I hadn't been to Ballymoney for about 15 years, and I didn't know how to get there. And I thought to myself, well, how hard can it be to get to Ballymoney? So I went on to Omagh, because I knew that I usually carried a map in the pocket of the car. And I went on to Omagh, and I got to Omagh, and I stopped, and I opened the glove compartment of the car. And lo and behold, I had cleared the car out, and there was no map there. And I thought, well, I'll just head on north, because Ballymoney is near Ballymena. Ballymena is a big place, so there's bound to be plenty of signs for Ballymena. So I headed on to Cookstown, and I drove around Cookstown, and there was no signs for Ballymena in Cookstown. So there was somebody walking along the street, and I stopped with them, and I said, you know, how would you get to Ballymoney or Ballymena from here? And he says, I don't know. So I thought, well, I'll go on to the next town. And I came to the next town, and it was Moneymore. And there was two branches. The road branched off in two. You could go down to Coleraine, or you could go to Macherfelt. And I thought, what am I going to do now? So round the corner from on the Macherfelt Road, there was a big filling station. And I went into the filling station, looked about them. There was no sign of any maps. So I went to the fella at the counter, and I says, what would be the best way to get the Ballymoney from here? And he says, I don't know. So I came out, and I thought to myself, well, my father, when we used to stay in Portrush on holidays, he used to go to the Ballymoney church at night at times. And I thought, well, it must be somewhere near Portrush. And since Coleraine is near Portrush, I'll go to Coleraine. I head towards Coleraine. So I headed off towards Coleraine, and eventually came to Mahara, and there were still no signs for either Ballymena or Ballymoney. So I kept on heading north, and out just about 2 or 3 miles outside Mahara, there was the first sign for Ballymoney, and I thought, have it now. So you go through Kilray, and you come down onto the main Risharkin to Ballymoney Road. And as you go down this road, enter towards Ballymoney, you come down, and all of a sudden Ballymoney opens out in front of you. And I came down, and you know, Ballymoney was an awful lot bigger than I remembered being. And I didn't know Bernice's address. I didn't know where she lived. I didn't have her phone number. I didn't know at all. So I thought to myself, you know, nobody knows I've been here. And I'm just going to turn and I'm going to go home and nobody will know about it. And then nobody will say anything about it because I think I've wasted my time. So then I remembered her saying that when she looked out her window that she could see an army camp or a UDR camp. So I looked over the town and there were two masts. And one of them, from being a policeman, I knew to be a police mast. And the other I knew to be an army mast. So I headed towards the army mast. And eventually I went up and down that road and I found her car. And that car was, that street was well filled with vehicles. And the only place I could get called in was outside, was opposite the gates of this UDR camp. And I was sitting there and I was getting cold feet again. And I thought to myself, what am I going to say when I knock the door? And I knew that she lived with her boss, the headmistress at that time. And what am I going to say if she answers the door? And again, I was getting cold feet and I thought to myself, you know, I'd be better just heading off here. I'd be just better going home and nobody will know. And just at that minute, there was a knock on the door and I looked up and I was surrounded by army personnel with their guns and all the rest. So I wound down my window and he said to me, what's your name? And I told him. He says, have you any identification? Oh, yes, I have identification in my glove compartment. And I opened the glove compartment and you'll remember that I cleared the car out because before, so when I looked in my glove compartment, there was no, oh, and I said, sorry, I thought I had it there, but I don't have it. And he says, what are you doing here? And I says, well, I'm here to see a girl. And where does she live? And I says, well, I don't know. So you can imagine sort of what's going through his head at this stage. And he says, well, I mean, if you don't know, what is her address then? And maybe we can tell you where that is. And I says, well, I don't know that either. And so you can see what's probably going through their head at this stage. And he says, what are you doing here? And I says, well, I'm going to, well, I says, that car up there, she was a wee mini metro at the time, that's her car. So they done a vehicle check on it, and it came back, it didn't come back to her at all. I think it actually came back to her father right enough, but her father had a Newry address. And of course, a Newry address didn't help things either. So after a wee bit of negotiating and things like that, eventually they decided that I wasn't too bad. But that left me in a predicament because I could see that they had gone in and they were watching me. And I thought, it's going to look straight. I can't drive off now. I'm just going to have to go. So I went then and I knocked the door. Unfortunately, it was Bernice was there, and that was the start of how I met my wife. But I thank God for her. And you know, since that, I have had many things that have happened in my life. I could go on for quite a bit. I was involved and I found a device in the corner grade road. But the way it was situated, because the traffic was being kept going on the road, it wasn't stopped. They didn't know whether there was a device or not. And I had to keep the dog close to me. And he didn't actually find it until I was standing level with it. And I thank God again for his mercy that whoever was on the end of the device, it was one of them horizontal motors, had already left at that time. In 1992, between the two ceasefires, it amazed me how quickly policemen didn't react the way that they used to bomb threats. And there was a bomb call came to the town hall in Enniskillen, and I arrived at it, And the sergeant said to me, there's a suspicious device up there. I want you to send your dog up to it to see whether it's a bomb. And I says, no. And he looked at me and he says, what do you mean, no? And I says, well, I'm not sending your dog up to it. I said to him, you know, when a suspicious device has actually been found, it becomes the bomb disposal team's job then to dispose of it. And I said, have you called him yet? And he said that he hadn't. And I says, well, you need to call him. I says, you need to move yourself away from here because you're far too close to it. I says, if the ATO comes, he'll fry you alive for being too close to it. And that's not to say if the device goes off, you're in a dangerous position. And he was just moving the cordon away from it. And we were just the last ones to walk away from it when the device actually did explode. And I can remember standing with my back to it, and I can remember my ears flapping forward with the force of the blast. So again, I can thank the Lord for his mercies during the time that I was in the police. I left the police it's almost 2 years ago. I started work in the laboratory in Oma. And part of the work is something that probably wouldn't be the nicest part of it. There was a fellow in the laboratory who done the mortuary work, and when somebody died, it was his job to take them away from the ward and bring them down to the mortuary. But there was two other of us in the labs. If he wasn't there, we had to do it. And I know you young people sitting here in the night, maybe you're thinking of a career, and you're probably thinking to yourself, you know, I never thought of that one before. I wonder what qualifications you need for that. And I would have to say it would be an interesting one to ask how you would ask your careers teacher for a bit of work experience. But even that work, doing that job, not a pleasant job, but you know, even that has spoke to me. Most of my job was in the lab doing blood tests and things like that, but this was part of the duties as a lab assistant. And you know, there was times when I brought a body out and I looked at that person and you know, they were only a short time dead. And you know, quite often there was still some of their residual heat in their body still from death. And you know, as that heat dissipated and as you looked at that person, I couldn't help at times a tear come to the eye, you know, because when you looked at that person, you realised that their eternal destiny had already been sealed. And you know, it's an awful final thing to see a person like that and say, you know, that person, they're either in hell or they're either in heaven or hell, you know. And there was many of them that would have had their hands clasped up in front of them, and there would have been a rosary bead wrapped around their hands. And you know, there would have been that realization that for them the works was the important thing. They had tried to rely on their works to get them to heaven. And you know, I realized by looking at them people that when you looked at it, it was very sad to think that there was a person and they were going to stand before the Lord and they were going to say, look what I've done. And he was going to turn to them and say, depart from me, I never knew you. And that was an awful thought to think when you looked on a body and realised that. And you know, I often thought to myself, I wonder when the last time that person was told of their need to be of a saviour. I wonder when the last time that person was given a track. And you know, men and women that are saved here tonight, you know, I often think, you know, at times, do we really have a full grasp of what hell is going to be like for people? And if we do have, I often think to myself, why, what stops us from doing more? I often think, you know, if you were able to talk to somebody after they've died, would they say to you, you know, thank you for letting me live my life the way I wanted it. Thank you for leaving me in peace, for not trying to push your religion on me, for not trying to tell you what Christ can do for you. Thank you for letting me live in the world. You know, I think if it was possible that you could speak to them, they would say to you, why didn't you take me by force to hear the gospel? I know that's not something that will ever happen. But you know, it's an awful thought when you think of them people. You know, and it has given me, I believe, a burden for the souls of people. It has helped me in my Christian life. It has made me think of people more and more about them going, where they're going after the day. You know, I probably most of you have know that nearly a year and a half to 2 years ago I had an accident in Scotland, and I was like everybody else when you went in your hospital and when you went on your holidays. The thoughts of enjoying yourself, the thoughts of were getting to where you wanted to, and you know, your thoughts go away from what might happen. And I was simply crossing the road. It was my own fault. I crossed. Somebody had left a space in between at a traffic lights. I didn't see anything on the outside lane. I walked through. I was watching the traffic coming down. I shot out and bang, I was hit by a car. And you know, as I lay on the road, the people would tell you that your body goes into self-sustain mode. But you know, one of the first things that came to my head as I lay on the road was, if I stood before the Lord now, how would I account for my talents before the Lord? I believed I was saved. I believed I was going to heaven. But how would I account for my talents? And you know, I realized that I could be doing more for the Lord. You know, faith without hope, faith without works is dead too. And you know, we are required to do something for the Lord. There was opportunities that I got, and you know, the devil will always put excuses in your head. I got the opportunity of in the church. They were short of people to ferry children about on the children's meeting and to help in the children's meeting and one of the children's meeting in Tresna. And you know, the devil would say to you, you can't speak. You can't. You're no good with children. You're not a sociable. You're not good at talking. You'd be no good at that. And you know, the devil will try and prevent you from getting involved. And I went to Mr. Gray and I said to him, you know, if there's nobody else, I'll be willing to help out. I'd be no good at this, but if there's nobody else, I'll help. And you know, I was the only one that offered for this particular meeting. And I was afraid that I wouldn't be able to do anything in them meetings, because when you go to them meetings, you know, you gradually get roped into doing different parts of the meeting. And you know, I thought about Moses. I had been reading and it came to me about Moses, you know, and how the Lord said to Moses, when Moses said, I'm not eloquent of speech, and he said to Moses, Who made man's mouth? Or who maketh the dumb or deaf? Or who seen or the blind, or have not I the Lord? And you know, the Lord is the creator, and he will make us, he can make us do whatever he wants us to do. If he has given it to us to do something, he will fit us out for it. And you know, I can thank God that I can say that that's very through the night. And you know, I got involved in the children's work. And then this year I felt I had been filled for a while, led to help in the Christian school. And I just started there 3 weeks ago. And I have to say, it is a rude awakening, but I have managed to survive thus far. But you know, no matter what we do, no matter what we are, no matter who we are, you know, God commands us that we should be doing something for Him. You know, in Ezekiel 6, he talks, or Ezekiel 33, sorry. He talks about us being the watchman. He talks about Christians being the watchmen. And he likens us to that we need to be sending the warning to those that are out of Christ, warning them about what will happen to their souls if they die without Christ. But he also gives a warning, I believe, to us who are Christians, and those that wouldn't do as the Lord bids, you know, and it says in Ezekiel 33, verse 6, "But if the watchman see the sword come and blow not the trumpet, and the people be not warned, if the sword come and take any person from among them, he is taken away in his iniquity, but his blood shall I require at the watchman's hand." And you know, that's a solemn warning, I think, to us all, and I believe that is our duty and our call, if we are saved by the Lord's grace, to be a watchman and to warn sinners of their need of a Saviour. Thank you very much.